Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. And on today's episode, I sit down with cinematographer, director, and all-around Renaissance man, Bruce Dorn. Bruce has been making images and telling stories for over 40 years. Although his early work was all about creating stunning still images for major magazines and ad agencies, his natural storytelling abilities led him to Hollywood and right into the Directors Guild of America. We'll talk a little bit about the glory days of big bucks TV commercials and how the tools have changed, but the job remains the same. And is the next big jump in image technology coming from the lighting side of the business? All this and more when we come back with Bruce Dorn. So sit tight. We'll be right back. Welcome to the show, Bruce. Thank you so much for doing this. I truly appreciate it.
Tim, I'm happy to be with you.
It's good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm good. I have been COVID traced once, but I am healthy. I haven't caught it. Been an interesting 6 months for sure.
Yeah, I'm getting a little COVID crazy. It's good to see old friends and old faces.
Yeah, so. No kidding. I wanted to wear a mask just to be, you know, make sure I didn't contaminate you, because we got to do our parts.
It's all right. I'll wipe the screen down when we're done. So. All right. So thank you. Welcome to the show. The show is Hollywood How Did You Get Here with Tim Smith, and you are my guest today, Bruce Dorn. Bruce, I'm going to start with, how did you get here? I want to hear a little bit about baby Bruce and what exactly brought you to being a photographer and a cinematographer and so on. So
where did
it start?
Well, you know, I come from kind of an artistic lineage. I've got art genes on both sides, on my mom and dad's side. My dad is a fine draftsman, and on my mom's side, an uncle who's, I think he won the Prix de Rome back in World War II, was studying over there when the Nazis were a problem. He escaped Rome on a bicycle, I recall hearing, into Switzerland, someplace like that. Everybody in the family has sort of an artistic gene. I have, let's see, five cousins who all found their way to Hollywood one way or the other. We all come from the Midwest, Indianapolis, to be specific. I have two cousins who are Foley walkers, one who is a set photographer, shot a lot of PR stills for actors and actresses, and then Priscilla Ned Friendly, who is an editor of some renown. She's done a bunch of stuff. And then I trickled into Hollywood and found my way into being a director. So it was really odd. None of us, I think, had any aspirations particularly toward working in the biz, but all ended up in it. And did have my uncle was a Broadway actor. And so, you know, it's just a kind of a weird confluence of opportunity and preparation that got us to Hollywood. But
all right, so it's clearly a creative gene in your family.
Yeah.
But you moved towards stills first.
Yeah.
So for our audience now, just for the audience, since Bruce and I have known each other for more years than we're going to admit, I don't want to take for granted, but Bruce is a renowned world-class still photographer who has also moved into the moving image world, and that's why I asked him to be on the show. So, and where did you grow up?
So Indianapolis, grew up in Indianapolis, thought I would be an illustrator. I was the kid that, you know, in first grade, I was the kid that could color inside the lines, and then high school, I was the best artist in my class, and when not staying within the lines became the thing, I was pretty good at that too. So I thought I would be an illustrator. Actually got accepted to Art Center and thought I would go into automotive design. I'm kind of a gearhead. Thought I'd go into automotive design. But my family had some reversals, business reversals when I was in junior high. So money was tight. I had to pay my way through school. Although I had gotten accepted to Art Center, I was not going to be allowed to work while I was a student. So I had to turn down that opportunity. Ended up going to Heron School of Art in Indianapolis, which is Fine Art Campus for Purdue and Indiana University in Indianapolis, and got a Bachelor of Fine Arts there in Visual Communications. Minimal amount of photo training, like Photo 101 and 102. But while I was a student, I fell into a competition Dating a girl that worked at the mall. She was into fashion. I was into cars and stuff like that. Worked at the Texaco station. Running out of things to talk about, I was at the magazine stand buying my car magazines, and I saw the women's interest magazines. I picked up a Mademoiselle magazine, which was a title of a Condé Nast. Fell open to a college competition, a double-page spread talking about a college competition. Bought the magazine, entered the competition. It went back to the 1930s. A lot of the movers and shakers in the fashion industry in New York came through the guest editorship at Mademoiselle. I was the first male to win a position in it, and I won the position of guest art director. So between my junior and senior years, I went to New York, and first airplane trip ever was to New York City. Second airplane trip was to Iceland, to Reykjavik, to shoot sweaters for Mademoiselle. From there to Rome to shoot on the Spanish Steps and Paris. I went from zero to 60. I was just a kid with a camera in art school to suddenly I was kind of semi-darling of the fashion community.
This is
as
your
a
20s.
Photographer. Yeah, I'm 20. I think I wasn't even 21. And there's you know, a couple hours on that story, but I mean, culture shock in a major way. But I was suddenly shooting for Women's Wear Daily. I was shooting collections for like a Betsy Johnson, a Sonia Raquel, different designers of that time. Doing layouts on the magazine. I got to art direct Dwayne Michaels, Arthur Elgort. It was just crazy. And I know nothing about fashion. And it certainly knew nothing about it then, but I was kind of good with a camera and good at making women look pretty spectacular, I guess. And so boom, there I went. And graduated, went back out, shared a loft on Fifth Avenue with a glam rock band, and shot fashion stuff in the front, and we had a rehearsal stage in the back where the New York Dolls would rehearse. It was just crazy. I went from bumpkin to Manhattan, you know, in a matter of minutes, it seemed. And while I was there, I walked down the street to Time Life, actually was working, got on as a stringer for the original People magazine, with which was to be a replacement for Life magazine as a photojournalism magazine. Got a bunch of interesting photojournalistic assignments, which I actually enjoyed more than the fashion stuff. And Douglas Kirkland was my picture editor there at the time, or he was the most senior guy there. And actually, it was Neil Leifer, maybe, was the picture editor at the time.
So you're going back to Doug, who we both know and adore. And for anybody that's listening to this that wants to follow photography, that wants to look at photographers, there might not be a better photographer in the world than Douglas Kirkland.
If Doug hasn't photographed you, you aren't really anybody.
He has photographed me. It's one of my I'm keeping that picture. It's on the wall somewhere right around here. So yeah, it's the only picture of me I've ever liked. So. Yeah,
he's
a sweet and talented man, and you need to look him up, because every picture he's ever taken, you'll go, I know that one. Yeah. All right, so your story is unique, but I know a lot of photographers, and your story started with the same thing they all start with. There was this girl. I don't know why that is, but somehow a girl and a magazine kicks it off.
Yeah.
So what's the time span of that from, let's say, from school to Doug Kirkland world?
Oh, nothing. Really nothing. I mean, I literally entered the competition. I entered two competitions, the photo competition and then the guest editor competition. They picked me as guest art director, and I think I won the photo competition too. And then it was, they sent an editor out to see if I had all my arms and legs and if I was a psycho or not, you know, just kind of check me out. And then I heard I won the thing, and boom, I'm off and shooting. I'm shooting assignments. And then the period of time, it was like, you know, a chunk of time during the summer. It was a college summer program sort of thing. I, you know, made my way to Manhattan and 4,000 square foot loft at 19th and 5th, and I'm doing the work. And then I think I was out there for really only about 4 years, and I didn't feel like, man, I was going to be a smoke jumper. I'm kind of an outdoorsy guy. I like to do outdoor stuff, and Manhattan felt a little claustrophobic to me. It was fantastic. I loved it, but I kind of wanted to be out in the wild, be more free range. So I kind of folded my tents overnight, started drifting west, went back through the Midwest. I was offered a sabbatical replacement for one of the professors at the school I graduated from. That led to me teaching a full load at the university until I was 30. So fashion photographer, editorial photographer, ad photographer, faculty between 20 and 30.
So and you're, but you're a natural teacher. I've sat through 100 of your lectures, all fresh, all new, all interesting. You were what Canon called, Canon USA was calling an explorer of light. You were constantly at trade shows doing seminars. You and I worked a couple of them.
Yeah.
Did you, sometimes you felt like a teacher, sometimes you felt like a photographer. How much did you like teaching?
So it was interesting. So teaching was the fundamental building blocks of my capacity as a director. Mm-hmm. Because I've got art students. It's not like I'm just teaching, you know, math or something. I've got art students, and they're all different. They're all unique. And I felt my job was to get the maximum performance out of each one of them and help them to achieve their you know, greatest version of themselves as an artist. That's kind of what my mandate was. So I enjoyed teaching. I really did enjoy it. And I was still freelancing. I was going off and shooting underwater photography catalogs for an underwater camera housing manufacturer. And I was going on assignments. I followed the Ku Klux Klan for about 18 months for Time Life. So I had both going on simultaneously and ad work kind of things. Got married after about 5 years of teaching. My new bride, we got married, no honeymoon. She moved to Phoenix to become the creative director at Gray Advertising in Phoenix, open a new branch. I taught out my contract, and then I joined her. So then from, you know, now I'm 30, and first few years in Phoenix, there's not the same kind of still photography I was used to doing. There was more annual reports and, right, and resort photography and things like that. So I segued into that, helped to found the Art Directors Club of Arizona, as a way to suck up to art directors. And working there, I got my first opportunity to shoot motion. I got a call one day, and a guy goes, "Do you shoot film?" And I go, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm distractedly talking to him. Of course I shoot film. I'm a photographer. And as we're going forward, he's asking more questions, and I'm sort of paying attention and saying yes a lot, which has kind of been my theme, say yes a lot. And come to learn, he's asking me if I'm a cinematographer, if I'm a, you know, if I shoot motion.
Right.
And I had said yes so much, I was kind of committed. And now he's into, "You want an ARRI package?" I said, "Well, sure." And he goes, "You know, standard zooms and 400-foot mags." I go, "Yeah. You know,
yeah, 400. Sure, that should do it, right?"
"Yeah, it should be 400. You know, and he goes, "Well, 4,000 feet of film work?" "Yeah." "Oh, yeah. Yeah." You know, and then I, because we had no Google, I raced to the library, and as miraculously as it might be, there was an operator's manual for an ARRI 3C. And I grabbed that thing, and I figured out that a movie camera was a still camera with limited shutter speed control. You still had aperture, and you had to do all the stuff, and I figured I could do it, and showed up on the job. And director was a actor's director, not a crew director, not a camera director.
So you're really handling everything that's behind the piece of, behind the lens.
Everything but action and cut. And yeah. Some of the guys on the crew understood that I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and were rather ruthless. And couple of them weren't, and the ones that weren't worked with me for many, many years and yep, traveled the world, and the other ones regretted it. But I mean, it was like, could we, I was trying to do everything. I was trying to put the camera on the dolly and trying to set the lights, and there were people that do those things, and it was, I was having to figure out all the things I was not supposed to do as much as what I was supposed to do. But turned out well. There was a million little comedic stories about me reading the storyboards and seeing that scene was 4 seconds and turning the camera on and off for exactly 4 seconds because I didn't had no concept of pre-roll and, you know, letting the camera roll after the fact.
Did this actually work? Did this become a real thing, or did you blow it?
I got to the Clios, dude.
On this project?
Yeah. Yeah. Man, yeah.
You're living under a lucky star. Okay, so look, I've worked
I am the luckiest human on the planet. Bad luck and good luck.
I have worked with so many still photographers, and one of my things in my career was to kind of watch them transition from stills to motion. Years and years ago, forget how many now, Canon came out with a camera on the still side called a 5D Mark II, which had this incredible motion, and all of a sudden, my career kicked into top gear trying to teach people, you did it too, how to make that jump. What I found was good still photographers can light like crazy, can compose like crazy, but not all of them could tell a story. A lot of them couldn't tell a story more than one frame at a time. And I'll ask you later, but I want to know if you think telling a story a single frame at a time is harder than telling it 24 frames at a time. But before we jump to that, because I don't want to forget, it's a question I wanted, something I wanted to ask you about for years, mm-hmm. and we just never got around to it at dinner. There's mm-hmm. one particular photograph you took, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you ever named it, but it's the marionette shot.
Oh, yeah.
You know which mm-hmm. one I mean?
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
because this is a podcast, you're going to have to describe it. But I want to know about that shot, because it's always been, you know, you put that one up a lot. I don't know if it's your trademark shot, but it's really cool. It's a picture I always wished I had taken, but I don't know where it came from, whether it was a single fashion shoot, whether it was a still from a motion event. Before we move into how you got your Clio, what was that about, that one particular shot? And it's probably on your website, right?
Yeah, I mean, my website is the most under maintained thing on the planet, but it's certainly on my Instagram, and I'll make sure it's back up there again. But I'm going to back up for a second.
Go ahead.
As a part of growing up, my father owned a chain of pharmacies, and they were old school pharmacies with soda fountains and the magazine rack and all the sundries and everything. And my job was keeping track of the comic books. So I had all of them from the late 1950s. I was born in 51. So I had the first Spider-Man. I had all of that stuff because I owned the comic book rack. So storyboards are simple for me. And I think in terms of Marvel comic shots, to be perfectly honest. I learned a lot about shot composition from Ditko and Stan Lee's work and all that stuff.
Right.
I have always done really meticulous storyboards for my work, and it has made me a darling of the crew people to some extent. I think of myself as a camera director more than an actor's director, but because the storyboards are so specific about what we're doing, the actors get it right away, and it's just really simple. I mean, a proper actor worth their salt looks at what I'm trying to do, and they get it. So telling a story through a series of shots, when I'm teaching still photographers, I talk about photo essays. And that kind of goes back to working for Time Life. You know, photo essay was the decisive moment. Doing a single shot that tells the entire story is fantastic. But if you can do a shot sequence like Dwayne Michaels, or if you can do a photojournalistic series of shots that tells a story, you're way ahead of the game making the transition. The shot that you're asking about, I enjoy making images more than I enjoy finding images. I really enjoy photojournalistic work and going out there and discovering what's happening spontaneously with juxtapositions of forms and shapes and light and all that. But I really like doing concept shots. And the marionette thing was just the secret life of a marionette. And I just kind of wanted to explore the physicality of it. And Canon had just come out with the latest iteration of the 1DX. And I shot each, for those who aren't seeing it right now, it's a series of like six or seven images of the same marionette, sort of a damaged doll. And, you know, she's got the strings on her arms and legs, and she's being puppeteered. I don't think I was really too deeply into the concept, but it was, you know, somebody's always pulling our strings, you know,
right.
You can't get through life without somebody pulling your strings. And it's really how you cope with that is a big part of determining who you are. But I just liked the visual of it, and I was exploring it. So it was a massive amount of pixels, megapixels on it, because each vertical stripe on that was, you know, 1DX. Shot. And so I had hopes that they would print it, you know, at some point life size. But that continues to this day. I'll just have something pop into my head that's a concept that I want to explore, and then I rapidly pursue it. I strongly believe that you determine your own future by the work that you choose to do. You know, I had some really great mentors, like at when I was at Condé Nast, the art director at Vogue was going, you know, you write, you do art direction, and you photograph, and you illustrate. You can't do all that. You're gonna have to find a pigeonhole because the world wants to pigeonhole people. And I'm going, well, I don't really know which one I like the best, you know. Yeah. But it was something that stuck with me, and it made me kind of, you know, eventually focus myself into the visual side, because while I love words and I like to write, I really like the image making process, and there is no better image making process than filmmaking. You know, it's the art form of the last century. And it makes
a difference. We watch these things, we watch shows, we watch these products, and sometimes we don't, the industry should take a bigger bow. Look, we've all been stuck in our houses for 6 months, maybe more. Who knows when you're going to listen to this?
Yeah.
And how many of us have just survived on taking that in? It's been sports dumped away. You know, we're watching documentaries. We're watching, I think when this world shifts, and I don't want to say new normal, any of that stuff, because who knows? But when the world shifts, it's already shifted. But when it shifts to where it's going to settle, you know, I think people have to understand that, or should understand that, it's more than just entertainment. It's part of our lives. You know, it's like this, that photograph. Okay. That image has been in my head for how many years? Would you say, what was that? 10 years ago now?
Yeah. Easy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know the story behind it, but what you got to go to his website, which is what? BruceDorn.com. Am I guessing?
Yep. Yep.
All right.
Yep.
BruceDorn.com. I know it's there cause I saw it the other day when I was trying to find your number. And it brought back all these memories. It's a beautiful shot. It's interesting. My mind goes into a million different places with, you know, whether these girls are broken, the strings, who's pulling their strings. Mm-hmm. And that's what took me to my question about, are you telling a story one frame at a time? The comic book thing makes it all gel in my head. That does make sense. But you're making, I don't know how you split your time, but you're doing motion as much as you do stills. Commercials for people, stories, docs, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Do you approach a doc or a commercial one frame at a time?
You know, I will say I really approach it from the story first. You know, I mean, I try to never miss an opportunity to listen. Mm-hmm. And to actively listen. And so while I'm a very verbal person and I loathe silence, when I approach a project, the first thing I want to do is understand what the problem is, what they're trying to do, what the story is trying to be communicated. And I just want the raw facts, because I'm a free associator. In fact, that was part of my training, and part of what I taught when I was teaching was association, brainstorming, synectics, all these kinds of creative techniques to sort of prime the pump or kickstart the motor when you just are dry, when just things aren't really happening. So that kind of stuff is kind of meat to me, you know, when there's a problem that needs to be solved or a story that needs to be told. I love that. And that's where I thrive. So it's different in a documentary, very different in a documentary, because you have to go there and find it, and you can't manipulate and impact the trajectory of the action or the story. Mm-hmm. I've really learned that with The Clan and some other kinds of things that I was around. But then if I'm trying to tell the story of a corporation and their unique selling proposition, and they still haven't identified it with their, you know, all the people in marketing and all that, nobody has ever finally figured out what the unique selling proposition is. And I can come in sort of as a hitman throw it to me and let me work on it.
And, well, there's lots of ways to do that. I mean, there's documentaries in the, conventional way of saying, you know, like The Clan, like what we're watching. I love documentaries. But that story, you don't know the ending. If you do, it's not a documentary. You know, you got to follow it, see where it goes. If you know the last act, you didn't make a documentary.
Yeah.
Now, the corporate stuff is more like documenting,
Yeah.
And we've both done tons of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that has its own trick and its own art to it as well. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to communicate a feature or trying to communicate a concept, knowing what the story, what you want to tell, but how do you do that visually? Different challenge too.
Very
and I think that gets a little short shifted as well. Nobody's sitting at home watching Netflix corporate ads, but that's a real art form too as well. So
yeah, I did a thing for one of the contract furniture manufacturers. They came out with the first ergonomic office chair, and they were going to sell a million of them. Sure. You know, like the chairs for airports and things like that. And these guys came in from Michigan. These suits came in, and they go, "We have this chair. It contours to you. You, at the end of the day, you feel better than when you went to work. We need to communicate that in 27 different languages. So nonverbal would be good.
Yep.
It needs to be understandable as a visual thing in a trade show. You know, what are you going to do with it?" And I was just like, "Oh, wow!" And we did this whole big choreography thing. I got break dancers to create a highly stylized kind of sort of Kafka-esque office scenes, and it won every award on the planet. It was one of my first hot buttons in Hollywood. And then projects like that, when they come along, when Ridley Scott did the 1984 commercial, Commodore computers had their first little color computer, the Amiga, right. And they dumped a ton of money on me to try to do something. And we did this. I built this Escher set. You know, we didn't have, we were on the cusp of having computer graphics, but didn't have it yet. So everything was physical builds. And we built the endless staircases and this whole esoteric crazy thing to try to answer that. I mean, he and I ended up in a story in Time Magazine or Newsweek's thing about advertising. I got mentioned in the same breath, which I thought was hilarious. But we had more money per second in commercial production than the highest budget feature film ever, because that's where all the techniques were developed. And that's kind of why I stuck in commercials, because I just loved the fact that we could constantly innovate. The expectation that was that you would do something new, and the expectation was that it's risky. So, on a movie, unless you've got the final cut, you don't know how it's going to turn out, and it's a big chunk of your life. And to be perfectly honest, I just kind of made an economic decision and a creative decision. I at this point in my life, I'm kind of regretful that I didn't go into long form.
Yeah.
But in commercials, I got to see my family. I got to see my kids grow up. I made good dough, and I got to do something different pretty much every day. And, you know, by the time I got to Hollywood, it was because I was good at live action and I seemed to understand the mechanics of production. And I got hired at the biggest special effect house in the world at the time. They were creating vector graphics that led to raster graphics, Robert Abel and Associates. They were digital production, and Robert Abel and Associates Digital did Tron with some help from Robert Abel. And Robert Abel did the first Star Trek movie. So, we had all of the computer guys. I think there were like 275 plus mathematicians trying to figure out vector or raster graphics. And then they needed live action people that could direct talent to work with invisible stuff. And so that was one of my first hooks in Hollywood, was having kids who need to interact with a CGI character and make it plausible, make the kids able to do it, that kind of stuff. So storytelling and the mechanics of storytelling are kind of two things that have blended for me, left brain, right brain kind of stuff.
But ultimately, it's the storytelling.
Yeah,
the mechanics might make it interesting. Look, there's a generation from when we were kids that know the phrase, "Where's the beef?" And they know the phrase, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" Mm-hmm. One of them was on the screen for 30 seconds. The other one was from a feature film that was a blockbuster. But they both made that mark, that indelible mark. They both hit the mark.
Yeah.
One was a Wendy's commercial, and the other one was a Clint Eastwood film. It was Dirty Harry, I guess. But you know, it's I love commercials. I don't skip them. You know, it's when they're really well done. You don't forget them. When they're not well done, you took up 30 seconds of your time. But there are times when I've seen a commercial and thought, wow, that was something. And no matter how people talk about it, commercials make a difference. Otherwise, people wouldn't pay for them. You know, there's these stories that say, you know, it's just a TV show. You know, people aren't going to go shoot other people because they saw it on TV. People aren't going to go buy that car because so-and-so was driving it. Oh, hell yes, they are.
I can't tell you how many times I got a job that was, we want to sell a shitload of Big Macs next Wednesday.
Yeah.
You know, and you did us. I worked for every soft drink company, every fast food company, every car company, every airline, every bank, every car. And all of them had a specific thing that they needed to do. And that was one of my things is I listened and I figured out what it was that they were struggling with and what it was they actually needed to accomplish. And then I would figure something that bridged those those different sides of the span. And I love the challenge of you know, making, motivating people, you know. And I did the first thing that I did that went to the Clio's was light comedy. It was, you know, and so lifestyle, light comedy, extreme action, all kinds of things. I loved all the different categories, and it was a very entertaining life for me because you never knew what you were going to get next. Right. The phone would ring, you'd get some storyboards coming in, and you'd look at them and you go, oh, heck yeah, you know.
I mean, the power to do something in 30 seconds that motivates somebody to leave their house and spend money.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. I mean, I don't think I love commercials. I don't know how much longer they're going to be effective the way they are. You know, cause we've figured out a way around it, but when I got a chance to work on a commercial, you know, it wasn't one of those things where the company I worked for wanted to like do a 3-page ad on guess who's working with this gear. Cause it was a commercial, but boy, the creativity on a commercial. And you're talking about the heyday of commercials when they actually were pretty profitable for the
industry. Yeah.
That was a license to print money back in those days on a TV commercial.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, we
get a car commercial.
We had crazy budgets, you know, and all over the planet. You know, I got to have do a real estate package, Remax, and we shot Romans coming into the Citadel in Cairo on chariots. You know, I mean, who gets to do that kind of stuff? Yeah. I got to go do a medieval assault on a castle in Ireland when Mel Gibson was doing Braveheart. I was trying to hire whatever reenactors he didn't have to do my own thing about one king trying to get the real estate of another king. And it was big action, big stuff, and a lot of problem solving and budgets and time. It was really great. And it was interesting to be at the effects house in the capacity I was, which was a live action person that is actually paying for all the research and development that led to the creation of the raster graphics that gave us the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, the math. Somebody had to pay for that. I was one of the guys helping to pay for that. And then when it came time to blend people with stuff, first mocap stuff, we did the first mocap stuff where we brought in some dancers and put them in dance skins and went down to the Office Depot and got those Avery dots and put them on all of the joints. And then I remembered from high school drafting class that if you had a top view, a side view, and a front view, you could describe any 3D object. So we had three Mitchells set up, and somebody went out and on the dance floor and did this movement, and then they went in and tracked each one physically, mechanically, to get the first wireframe animated skeleton onto which we could put a monkey or whatever. And that led to the 25 cameras on the face, getting all of the subtle actions of Circus, that guy Andy Circus. But all of that stuff started like analog ended and CG started. I built giant spaceships, and then we made 3D miniature models of spaceships. I like the analog era a lot.
I think we're a long way from that. I think that one of the things that's happening today, tonight, tomorrow morning, is COVID has sped up the virtual set designs, the in front of screens, the actors on a stage that have never been to the Coliseum being plopped in the Coliseum without all of that work, essentially, mm-hmm. with a huge high graphic screen behind them. Everything is blended. Everything is right there. We're buying and believing all of it, which is wonderful because that's the point of storytelling. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a different world.
It's a different world. It's a new challenge. I was watching the behind the scenes on Mandalorian with mm-hmm. the volume, with the, gaming software to be able to make the LED screens in the background light up, LCD, yep. make them light up as the camera moves around, the virtual reality stuff. And I'm going, yeah, because I saw that coming 30 years ago. I said, we're going to have synthespians. We're going to have virtual reality. And we were trying to figure out at that time, you have to interact with this object, so we have to have the base of the giant robot, but we can build the rest of the giant robot, or here's the walls of the Coliseum, and then we'll add the grandstands beyond that. Being there when all of that stuff was going down was like eating candy all day. It was I sense it's an important time right now. In difficult times, interesting things occur. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I hear from one side of the geopolitical spectrum, I hear people saying that the arts are frivolous and we need to spend more money on something over here. There's one thing that AI and robotics can't really do, which is random, creative, crazy. And, I think for the first time in history, it may be really not that stupid to get into theater, or to get into theater design, or to get into art, or get into music composition, getting a degree in musical composition. Your parents got to be tearing their hair out. And yet, those may be the most desirable things going forward, because humans can do human things. And the AI is trying to mimic us, but we got
it'll be different. It'll have to find its mix. Yeah. There's a trick that cinematographers have been doing since the digital age started, and pushing in on resolution. Yeah. Getting that wide shot and the close up in the same cut. Mm-hmm. It never works. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work because there's a human being in front of the camera. And that human being, whether they know it or not, is focusing their energy where that camera is pointed. If it's an emotional scene, and I've seen it done, where the actor has to put that emotion in their mouth and their eyes and their face, mm-hmm. and the camera's wide, mm-hmm. and then just pushed in, there's something about that. I mean, we'll find the balance of this, mm-hmm. but visual effects will get more spectacular than ever. They will get to the point where we don't talk about them, which means they're there. Mm-hmm. We all left Star Wars and said, oh my God, they blew up the Death Star. That's going to be nothing. If we noticed they blew it up, it would be poorly done. So it'll just, everything will be transparent. I don't know if it's in my lifetime. I don't know if it's in yours, but our kids have got some stuff coming that we can't even fathom.
So, I strongly feel there's no story that can't be told right now. I feel like for the first time, it's not only any kind of fantastic storytelling is feasible, and it's rapidly becoming accessible. Mm-hmm. I remember when we actually had a Cray supercomputer, but before that we had Evans and Sutherland mil-spec military computers, and it took, how long did it take? It took 72 hours to render one frame of raster imagery. Mm-hmm. 30-second spot, 720 frames. So you're talking about 6 months to deliver the project. The rate at which technology accelerates. But it still comes back around to the storytelling, a good story. All of the technical grammar in the world doesn't make your story interesting.
No, it doesn't. That takes all the way back to where I said still photographers made great lighting. Yeah. And I'm not putting it down, because a lot of them made the jump. But the hardest thing to teach, which I don't know if you can teach, is storytelling. I think mm-hmm. you can teach storytellers to be better storytellers. Mm-hmm. But I think some people that don't have the knack for storytelling, can never tell a story. And we've met them. They're at parties. They're trying to keep us entertained on New Year's Eve, telling us some story. We're going, this is a horrible story.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And it's about how you tell it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just about how you tell it. And
it's like teaching
some people are natural.
Spontaneous. Good luck. You know, you're either spontaneous or you're not, right?
Right.
You can't teach spontaneity.
It's like sincerity. As soon as you learn to fake that, you're all set. So, anyway. All right. So I'm going to be sincere here because I need to go to a commercial and pay some bills here.
We love
so
that.
So we do. We crave it. We crave it. All right. So we're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we're going to come back with Bruce Dorn and our section called Tools of the Craft. And we might even get a little more techie. So just hang in there for a minute, everybody. This week's episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? Is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code Hollywood when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code Hollywood at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. And we are back with Bruce Dorn, and this is our Tools of the Craft section. We're going to get a little geeky now, try to talk about what's out there and what you might want to play with. Bruce, what are you playing with these days?
Well, I'm still working with the hybrid cameras to a great extent. You know, I was the second guy to get my hands on the 5D Mark II after Vincent Loffray scammed his way into the office and spirited away the first sample over the weekend. A week later, they sent me one to play with. And so I've been interested in the small form factor since then. You know, I've got a lot of time in the industry, and I worked with everything from radioactive Rackover Mitchells that were military surplus process cameras to Panavision Platinums to Super 8 Belus and then GoPros and hybrid cameras. So the evolution of the tools is interesting to me. I'm kind of a mechanic at heart, and it is a mechanical art form. Mm-hmm. And each tool gives you another capacity to investigate, or another tool in the toolbox. And I'm very interested in what's going on with cameras and lenses as they push physics around a little bit. Lighting has always been a great differentiator for me. I didn't studied the Dutch masters, but I'm an artist, and I got a degree in fine art, and so I got art history and Caravaggio and some of the real greats. You know, they struck me. You know, W. Eugene Smith. You know, lighting something with a lantern. You know, I think he was one that said, "Available light is whatever is available." As the technology of the cameras has evolved, and ISO has become such a flexible component. When I was first shooting film, you had ISO 25, ISO 64, maybe 400 would be very sensitive low light film. Now you can, the ISO of the digital cameras is such that you can shoot in any kind of light. But just because you can doesn't mean you should.
So we're about to go, dude, just because you can. Now, all right, so we can do 300,000 ISO, 4 million on a particular camera that Canon sells. You know, there was that cry for a long time that you're not going to need light. Look how good these sensors are. You can shoot with no light at all. And
awesome.
There's some signs of time and a place for that, but I never found the art for it. I'll tell you about one film called Blue Jay. That was done on a Canon's ME20, which I think just got the Emmy, because it had a 4.5 million ISO sensor, and it was the Duplass brothers, a lot of actors you'd recognize. It was a love story. It was a narrative, and the plan was to shoot with whatever light you had whenever you had it. That was it. Yeah. Everything was either flip a switch on a light or go stand under the lamppost and shoot it. Good story, good acting, carried along, but still felt like a little bit of a gimmick because of the way it was done. Probably going to get in trouble for saying that, but I love the story. Just just to say, I did. It's worth watching. It's called Blue Jay. It's on Netflix. Go watch it. I guarantee you'll like the story. But there are no commercial lights on it. Mm. And I don't think that did the story a favor all the way across the board. Mm. There are certain scenes where there's a certain amount of intimacy and realness because there's not a ton of light running around.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain scenes when you miss the dramatic. The lighting isn't as dramatic as the acting, so to speak, and it mutes the acting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
would you shoot without light ever?
I mean, if
without
that
lighting,
was,
let's put it that way, yeah, without lighting.
Well, you know, a lot of the documentary stuff. Very often, I don't have an opportunity to.
Yeah,
so I have to have the craft. But I when I first got to Hollywood, I got there as a director, not as a cameraman. I mean, mm-hmm. I consider myself a cameraman. But I've been in the guild since 84, and I was at a big effects house, and our hook was we're the best. So I got to work with Bill Fraker. I got to work with Jordan Cronenweth. I got to direct Dick Klein. It was like going to school every day. These guys are absolute masters, and yeah. Jordan in particular, he was doing Stop Making Sense and had just come off Blade Runner when we started working together. And
I got to work with his son, Jeff Cronenworth.
Jeff was and a the whole assistant on some of our jobs.
But so. That whole shoot, every time I looked over there, I swear he was wearing had a red S on his chest and had a cape. It was hanging out with heroes all day long. Some of these guys. Wow.
They're,
anyway, sorry, you took me away there for a second.
They're
demigods, wow.
Demigods, you know. Yeah. And so I had the great good sense most of the time, keep my mouth shut, my eyes open, and look at what's going on. And then I'm naturally predisposed to think of every frame as a Rembrandt. You know, I just want every frame to be spectacular. One of the things that still photographers fall short on in the transition is the movement. They're called movies because the camera needs to move, the mm-hmm. subject needs to move, and so your composition is dynamic. You have to start with a great composition, you have to end in a great composition, and you have to look pretty dang good in between. And that means lighting in a certain way. Still photographers tend to light a face or a figure. Cinematographers have to light an environment and create pools of light and areas of shadow and block the talent's movements through the light and through the shadows in a way that is emotional and supportive of story. So as the lighting, the first thing I bought as a young man was a camera and a lens. And the third thing I bought was light. And I still have a horrible little Tota light that you could explode and shower you with molten hot glass.
The good old days.
But I still have that. But I've watched the evolution up through Kinos and HMIs and flickering HMIs, magnetic HMIs, some horrible times. And we're now in the LED era, and I'm a spokesman for Arri's sky panels and all of their wonderful theatrical instruments, an Arri ambassador. And then I'm also, I work with a smaller company out of Marina, California called Light and Motion. And they make introduced their product I'm an underwater filmmaker, photographer right. as well. And so they made these 8,000 Kelvin underwater lights that were super bright. And I sort of got a hold of the founder of the company and beat him up to make 5,600 Kelvin versions and 3,200 Kelvin versions instead of just the 8,000 Kelvin for the underwater stuff. And now we have a little light that's battery powered that can function while it's charging. You unplug it and it'll run for 90 minutes. And dimmable, remotely dimmable. And
is that what the beauty of LED lights is? The flexibility of the lighting?
Well, yeah. Yeah, the fact that it doesn't get super hot, it doesn't consume a lot of power. You don't have to tie into the mains when you go into a house. You can actually just plug into walls.
Right.
So the compactness of cameras and the efficiency of lighting are ushering in a new era, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you can work a lot faster, and you can still mimic some of the stuff that the grandmasters did with the giant instruments. I mean, when I was working with Jordan, he'd start with a brute up in the back of the stage and tell the gaffer to tweak it. He'd always start with a massive right. backlight somewhere far away and then bounce light around him. And now the smaller instruments allow you to work quicker. Yeah, just speed. And then they're beautiful. You know, they now that you have full spectrum capability with RGBW and with the area lights, I can have instantly have the flickering light of a computer screen. I can have the flickering light of a fireplace or a candle or fireworks or a European emergency vehicle or a New York cab. It's amazing. And I don't know if
what kind of light do you want now? I mean, the science between lighting and unlighting has changed. Oh my God, it's such a rapid speed. It's, you know, it's kind of like when digital took off, all of a sudden 3 megapixels became 30, became 300, became, you know, God knows where that's going to go, or even if it should. But lighting has moved at that same speed as well. You know, it's like, oh, LED, and then all of a sudden it's LEDs with RGBWs. And what light do you take with you everywhere? Is it kind of like a lens? I mean, as a still photographer, you never, there's one lens you have in your bag for every shoot. I'm sure of it. You might pick different ones, but there's at least one you always have.
As a still photographer, I always have two of the little Stella light and motion LED lights. Mm-hmm. I can travel on an airplane with them because it's not a separate lithium-ion battery, so I don't have any travel restrictions. If I'm near a window, I've got a daylight one, interchangeable from tungsten to daylight and dimmable. Always have those. And if I'm traveling by vehicle, I always have a couple of S60 sky panels and hopefully some kind of a Fresnel, because I'm a still believer in, yeah, sure, a broad source. I mean, I remember when everybody didn't have the collapsible soft boxes. You actually had to make something that was called a coupe out of foam core and tracing paper. And I'm still a champion of different kinds of diffusion medium rather than just whatever came from Chimera or whoever. And so I always carry a couple of small instruments. I always carry something big enough. Most of the things that are wonderful are lit by a single source, the sun. So if I have something big and bright, I can do a lot by bouncing it around, diffusing it, doing different things. And then I want something compact that I can work in a small space and dial it down. I would say as a documentary shooter or somebody trying to work subtly and quickly, my goal is not to recreate lighting, but to sweeten the light. So if I walked into an environment to shoot with you, there's a window, there's a sconce, there's a practical over here, there's different things going on, but you're going to be at a certain point in the room and I want the light to be particularly sweet where you're at. And so I would have something that I could do that quickly and efficiently and take advantage of what nature and some architect or interior designer had provided and just make it better. So that's what I do if I got 10 seconds. And then if I got more time now, I'll put Duvetine outside the window and put something out there to make the light consistent for multiple hours of shooting. That was always the thing. You had to kind of cancel out voluntary sunlight because it was going to take you forever to shoot the scene and the sun would move and it would screw it up. But now you can work so fast, you really don't have to do that anymore. You can just decide we're going to move quick. The sun won't outrun us and we'll still make it look good.
So there was this thing that I was starting to get into right before the world went nuts. So, you know, January, February, a little bit in the late in the last year, I went to this seminar that was being taught by Richard Crudo, ASC, super cinematographer. Actually, he's already been on the show, so if you want to hear about Richard, look in the archives.
Yeah.
And Rodney Charters, who did 24 for all those years, and Shameless, and Rodney's reputation is unmatched almost. And they were doing this lighting seminar, where all the lighting was reflected. Essentially, they were lighting an entire set with one light and reflecting it off panels everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it was really fascinating. I've not wrapped my head around it yet. Mm-hmm. I saw it work. I know that the concept is brilliant, but it makes me rethink all of these things. Have you heard of this? I know as a still photographer, as a motion, we always bounce something somewhere. You know, we're always looking to reflect somewhere. But this was literally sort of, how do we have one light find 10 different sources by bouncing it off these really super reflective lightweight panels that don't need to be plugged in? And it's playing, was really beautiful.
Yeah, it's playing billiards with light.
You know, yeah, it was.
You know, and I saw that with Jordan. He always started with a really strong backlight. Like, look at Peggy Sue Got Married or Blade Runner or any of them. And always starts with something in the back and then start bouncing around. And you start to look. You can reverse engineer a lot of imagery by just looking at it, and particularly looking really close at the eyes and seeing where the reflections are mapped in there. But I think the greats are minimalists. they may be, use really big instruments, and they may have a lot of people to move these panel reflectors around and different types of diffusion. So it's not something where they're just not putting in the effort. It's a less is more thing. It's like a haiku. It's like a lighting haiku where it's minimalist.
Don't get me wrong. This was more effort than traditional.
Oh yeah, that's hard.
To do it this way. And the whole time they were setting it up, I thought, because I got there early, and it was like, I don't get it. And I'm glad I stayed. And then they kind of flip one light, and then boom, that stage comes to life with a spot hitting exactly where it needs to hit, and another one behind her head, and the book she's reading gets its own little key light, and it was brilliant in a completely different way. And when the world lets me out of this house, when I can climb out of this camera and do other things, that's what I want to focus on a little bit, is lighting, LED lighting in specific, and reflective lighting, and the combination of those two. Because I think you can get a lighting package down to next to nothing. You can get power use down to next to nothing.
Absolutely.
You don't have to pretend you're sitting in an oven all day long, sweating your ass off with all these lights. I may be long gone by the time they work out the whole science here, but there's a day when somebody's going to flip a light switch and a stage is just going to light up. And if somebody pulls the plug, the stage will go dark. And I still see it in still photography as well. I was never a flash fan. I was never bounce flash. I always wanted hot lights. You know, there was something about flashes only go off for a split second, so my brain doesn't see them the same way as ones that can stay on, so I can kind of, okay, that's what it's going to look like. You know, I always never really understood exactly how you pre-vised a flash. But
yeah.
I could do hot.
Yeah.
I mean, you did. I mean, you could. You're a master still photographer. I worked for a manufacturer where I pretended to know what I was talking about, and you actually had to do it. So it's a different story, but hot lights were easier for me to comprehend. So,
The early days, I jump on it for a second. So I learned to work with strobes pretty early because you could at least control the intensity of them. Hot lights, you couldn't really turn them down. You had to drop wire in and reduce.
Yeah.
So changing intensity while keeping them the same distance, because you move a light back and it gets dimmer, but it also changes character. So learning to light with strobes is kind of learning to light with theory. And then if you've got the theory, it transitions to everything else. So by the time I got to continuous light, it was like, oh, this is so much easier because I actually see what's going on. But the struggle was getting it to the point where you could dim it without it being something that physically got you burned, you know? And then another thing, just jumping into when you were talking about when I get out here and I'm going to go, one of the things that I do when I'm teaching is I have an exercise that I call creating a scene from a movie. And the marionette thing was kind of like that, but I've done a series recently where I was inspired to hear that Margot Robbie has optioned Tank Girl, and she's going to redo Tank Girl. And I remembered that movie was really weak in the 80s, but the graphic novel is interesting. So I started doing, I created an action character and I started doing essentially movie posters, or I'll like to do a scene, kind of like, you know, Nighthawks, where you've got this real moody scene in the streets of New York or something. Go out. That's a great exercise for still photographers or just photographers in general. Imagine a scene from a movie and go create it. You don't have to do the whole movie. As a still photographer, if you take on the task of learning that, you're learning a lot of the grammar of filmmaking by just trying to do a scene.
And deconstructing scenes that have already existed.
Yes, and get into color theory and all that stuff. Yep. So that's something that I'm exploring right now as some color theory projects. So,
well, let me do a shout out to some of the people that are listening. Okay, so Richard Crudo, who we just mentioned earlier, has a blog where he has saved every note from everything he's ever touched, I think. And he's got all these diagrams. It's a fascinating block that he started during COVID, where he's deconstructing famous work about how it was lit and how it was shot. If you really want
to
dig into something while you're sitting home on your computer, try his normalexposure.com, I think is what it is. If not, look, we have a site to support this show called The Art of the Image with Tim Smith on Facebook. I know it's posted up in there. Go to that one too if you want to see it, but check out Richard's blog on that too. It's a great place to learn these kind of things. What else are you playing with? What are you doing in for cameras these days? I think there's 20 cameras that have come out in the last 6 months between the Canons and the new Alexa, the new Reds, the new 12K Blackmagic cameras. there's a ton of stuff. And in the normal world, we would have played with all of these by now, but we can't. So what are you thinking of those things?
Well, I'm grinding on my friends at Canon to get me some of these latest samples of the Cine EOS cameras to play with. But in the meantime, I'm doing more with the hybrids. I was in a focus group half a dozen years ago about lenses, and it's clearly led to the RF series of lenses that have recently been announced. I'm shooting with the R5, and in fact, in a couple of weeks from the time this is recorded, I'm going to be out on some of the classic movie locations in southern Utah doing a Western music video. And it's kind of a 1870s Romeo and Juliet, the little señorita on the south side of the Rio Grande and the cowboy who loves her and the disapproving parents. It's kind of a Romeo and Juliet theme. And I'm going to be exploring color theory on it. We're going to be doing some classic day for night techniques. And I'm going to shoot it with the new R5. Unless something else lands on my desk. Hint, hint, Uncle Cannon, if there's something else that you want me to thrash, I'd be thrilled to do it. But I'm going to go out there.
There wasn't a time when telling me that might help, but now forget it. You know, but I will tell you, the stuff that I saw before I left just recently, spectacular. The autofocus, the eye focus control, the RF mount, this new mount, which is a tough swallow for an industry. You and I live through mount changes from time to time, and it's painful. Yeah, it's painful for the end user. It's painful to the manufacturer. So Canon went from an FD mount to an EF mount and now to an RF mount, and that can be a challenge for anybody. But the advantage is going to this RF mount, what it can do for the glass. The camera itself they came out with was good. They always are. The RF glass is a whole new level.
It's just spectacular. A whole new level. This summer for me has been a cowboy caravan kind of thing. Everything has been cowboy. I've been doing workshops and working with wranglers and cowgirls and doing environmental portraits and all kinds of really interesting stuff. And so a lot of action. And of course the auto, I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but gosh, it's all so good. You know, the autofocus that can track an eye and, not that eye, tap on the other eye and it will track that one endlessly. You know, or object tracking where it recognizes that you want the hand going up and down the neck of the violin and it will track that one hand. And so, trying to adapt traditional techniques to new technology is fun. I find that very fun and entertaining. And I just look at these little cameras and I go, this just about is an IMAX camera. If I can make this 8K work, I just about got an IMAX camera in my
hand. You do.
And it's mind-blowing.
I've worked on IMAX projects, several of them. I worked on with an IMAX cinematographer named James Nyhaus. We put one on the space shuttle, sent it up into space. Right. We put one on the Hubble. When we did the Hubble piece, we did it with an HD 420 8-bit. I don't want to get too into the weeds, but that's not good.
Yeah.
And blew it to 70 millimeter film for projection. The tools you have for that are crazy good. Hey, you know what? Let me go to autofocus for a second. Because you already told everybody how old you are, so you're old school. How do you feel about autofocus? Man, the fight was huge with photographers and with motion people to ever touch an autofocus camera. You seem to have accepted it.
You know, I embrace technology. You know, I'm sidetrack here, but like everybody, film was so special. I'm happy as, watch the Game of Thrones or any of these other magnificent pieces and tell me that film, it would have been better shot on 35 millimeter film. I don't think so. I mean, it was great, but I'm tired of flushing chemicals down the drain. I'm too much of an environmentalist. I love digital. I embrace the new. And autofocus, I mean, like when you're doing the two spies meeting on the park bench in front of the Lincoln Memorial and you got a rack focus between one or the other and you just touch that face and then you touch this face and you can control the rate at which it throws the focus. God love focus pullers. They're artists. And I've known some geniuses that can pull focus on the logo on the front of a BMW has went from a million miles away until the matte box, and I respect that. But the technology changes what we can do,
It does.
And so I'm more than happy to embrace it. Everything is a struggle to make it bend to our wills, but it's getting easier and easier to do that.
I think in the still world, autofocus has gotten where it needs to be. There was a here's a quick story. All right. So a couple of years ago, I was in New York City at City Hall, working on a live television show. And the show was centered around that famous photograph of John Lennon and Yoko Ono in the white bed. It was the anniversary of that or something. I forget what it was about. But it was four camera people. I was running one of them. And we were going to shoot Yoko Ono, Ringo Starr, and Jeff Daniels? I'm blanking all of a sudden. Jeff, the dude. What's his name? I'm blanking on this one. You know. You know. Anyway, I'll get to that. But
senior moment.
Yeah, it's exactly what it was. But we're supposed to shoot this reenactment on the bed as an anniversary of the thing, and there's marching bands and all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. But the moment I remember the most is somebody walks up to me, one of the PAs, and says, there's a guy at the front that wants to come in to photograph this. And we don't know who he is, but somebody said, you work for a camera company. Maybe you've heard of him. And he gave me his card, and it was a guy named Henry Diltz. Do you know Henry's work? You must. Henry is the ultimate, he's a hero of mine. He is the ultimate rock and roll photographer.
Okay.
The James Morrison, every rock and roll album you and
probably,
I ever owned.
Yeah, Morrison Hotel.
Maybe, the Morrison Hotel maybe. Shot, mm-hmm. everything. He's mm-hmm. the guy that made me want to get into photography.
That was golden era of photography too, the album cover stuff.
Well, my very first concert I ever went to was a band called America, which probably still plays casinos somewhere. I was 16 or 17 years old, and it was at the local college. I had a date. We sat on the floor. We watched America. And I watched this guy with cameras around his neck on stage taking pictures of the band. And it was sort of, I worked at a camera store at the time, but all of a sudden the band introduced him. And he put the camera down, and he picked up a banjo, and he sat in with the band. And I thought, I want to be him when I grow up. And all my years, 30 plus years in the industry, I never ran into Henry Diltz. I always wanted to. So he shows up. I go. I escort him from the gate. I fanboy the crap out of this guy as we're walking over to the shoot. And he's got a camera around his neck, a Canon camera. And I go, hey, I work for Canon. And he shows me this camera. And he tells me the thing he loves the most about it is the auto mode. Because now he can just focus on composition. And I thought, I am absolutely crushed. I mean, all those years learning how to use a camera, and he puts it in the auto mode. But he was, you know, I don't know. You're a director. If you're telling somebody I need that pull to be from the actor's face to the crying bride, there's a human factor there that autofocus will never do.
Yeah.
But when you're doing your horse's stuff and your beautiful still stuff, you can do it, and probably even do it faster than you can do it. But
yeah,
so where does it play for you?
It's a tough call. I mean, I am an explorer by nature. You know, a lot of my self-motivated work is actually exploration. I'm involved with a bunch of guys that travel around the globe going to crazy places, and I just like trying to overcome challenges. Absolutely. There are times when then nothing is better than the human element in something. And that's why I'm starting to get back into handheld, not gimbal, handheld, because I kind of want the urgency and the chaos of the movement and so on. But, every time there's a new tool, I've just got to poke around with it and see what I can do with it. And sometimes hopefully I find a new classic, you know, because some of the, like you're describing the emotion controlling where the viewer's eye goes, you know, is a huge tool in storytelling. Yeah. That lets you know that when the camera suddenly goes to the person who's not talking and you get that one little twitch of the eye, their tell, you go, right. Oh, that's the villain right there. Right, there's so much there. But that's not to say that you can't improve upon the mechanics of it, you know. So it's always a give and take. You know, there's still times when I take an adapted FD lens and put it on because it's got single coating and it's goofy looking in a romantic way. So I just enjoy exploring the process. And
are you still inventing? You built this follow focus rig that was basically a clever use of a roller skate wheel.
Well, I started with a skateboard.
I still have it.
I ended up coming up with a way to do a helical. So you have straight cut gears and you got 90 degree gears. I came up with a 45 degree, a diamond shaped gear that I could do a follow focus on the traditional 8-pitch ring and all that. But yeah, I at one point I had designed about 300 unique components and won some industrial design awards. But it was to put a follow focus on the hybrid cameras before anything was available. In first iteration of the 5D Mark II, you couldn't control exposure really.
Right.
You know, and they're fly-by-wire lenses and all this kind of stuff. But no, I built that company up to a very successful level just before technology sort of destroyed its foundation. So
I still use mine. I, you know, even for stills, there's just that sense of control. I will say that, let me rephrase it. I don't use it on the new RFs. I haven't moved it to an RF. The autofocus system in the new Canons is stunning. You're going to get to play with it. And I mean, I have a friend who uses the eye control and it'll do eye control on a bird.
Yeah.
Try doing that on your own.
Yeah. Animals. Yeah. No, it's crazy. It can do stuff you can't. I remember, was it the, Canon Elan that had where you looked at you set up
the eye control
that I shot another brand and I got my wife a Canon so she wouldn't steal my lenses and stuff, and she was trying to set it up and she couldn't figure it out, and I got it, and you basically looked at different places in the frame and then it tracked your pupil.
Right, you followed your pupil after you calibrated.
After you got it calibrated, wherever you looked in the frame, that was in focus. And I went, what happened to that? I thought it was great.
Well, we moved it to a still camera. We moved it over to a motion. We started in a still camera. We moved it to the motion side. I want to think it was called an ES500 or from something like that, a little handheld high 8 piece. Oh. And that was back in my days. And one is it worked just as well, but the problem is you don't keep your eye in the same spot when you're storytelling. And it would follow it. You would catch something in the corner of your eye.
Painting in the background or something.
Right. Or you'd see movement from another character or whatever. So that would sort of throw you off. And the other thing was there was this enormous fight with the medical community. People all of a sudden wanted to know, what are you pointing at my eye?
Oh,
is this a laser? Is this a whatever? And none of it was true.
Yeah.
But I think it came and went fairly quickly in that one because it was going to be a fight to prove to people it was really a strange situation. But the bigger thing was that it didn't really adapt itself to motion.
Great in
the
stills.
Way it did to eyes. It was great for stills, but on the motion standpoint, look, and you don't want it on your vacation cam when you're walking down the beach and your eye wanders to the other girl on the beach. So, you know, it was, and your focus shifts. So there were some strange stories, but it was a funny eye control. I remember the eye control camera. I want to say it was a 500. Wish I'd kept that one. It would have been a classic. So, but it did work. Did everything we said it was going to do. So, all right. So we are probably running long and I hate to end this, but I kind of have to. Thank you so much. It's not easy to get legends to show up on this. I truly appreciate it. I miss the dinners, man. I miss the time.
I
miss having these conversations when there was nobody around. So
yeah,
I really appreciate doing this. You look great. Nobody can tell because it's a podcast, but trust me, it looks great. I hope our paths will cross again. So
absolutely.
Any closing, anything you want to, any goodwill for the world or something?
You know, buck up, get out there, create. We'll get past this stuff. But if you have a creative outlet, exercise it. If you don't find one, that's what makes life worth living. It's not a dress rehearsal.
All right. And for my audience, look, we have a rule on this show. We've had it since day one. We don't really talk COVID, at least other than to reference it. And we don't talk politics. But this show will air in a couple of weeks. All I will say is go vote. Vote for somebody, vote for your choice, but go vote. Bruce is going to vote and I'm going to vote and you should vote too. So, don't let the country run you. You get to run it. So,
right on. Anyway. And I'm going to say vote on election day. I want people to get out there. I know it's kind of, it's a big
ask. Now we're getting political.
I want you to go out there on election day. I just want you to show up on election day.
Well, he wants to go take pictures of it. I don't care where you vote. Just do it. Just, you know, be a citizen, play your part. All right. So thank you so much, Bruce, for coming on to this. I really appreciate it. I'm more than willing to do this again without even recording it. I love talking to you. So I appreciate you coming in.
Next time I'm over on the left coast, I'll come grab me and we'll go get a meal sometime.
Oh, you know what? We'll do this in studio next time. That would be fun. As soon as we're allowed to, let's go in studio and do this again. So I really appreciate it.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy. Everybody, just hang on for a minute and we will be right back. Well, as they say, that's a wrap. I'd like to thank my guest, Bruce Dorn, for taking the time to talk with us and you for listening. Don't forget to visit his site, brucedorn.com, and follow him on Twitter @@BruceDorn, BRUCEDORN. And if you want to talk with me about the show or just talk tech, you can find me at our Facebook page, The Art of the Image with Tim Smith. Before you go anywhere, take a minute to hit that subscribe button so we can keep you up to date on all the latest episodes. Stay safe, be healthy, and we'll see you next time on Hollywood, How Did You Get Here?